It is also my privilege to recommend, to introduce somebody who really is one of, I think, the most important and best leaders we have in the state of Florida. And one of the reasons I say that is, you know, people who serve in government, serve on courts, serve at agencies, serve in the executive branch or legislative, they get a lot of recognition. But we have a lot of leaders throughout this state in the business community, in the philanthropic community, who are doing really yeoman's work, advancing the cause of liberty, advancing economic success throughout the state. And the president of the Florida Chamber is one of those people. Mark Wilson drove down this morning to join us. He's going to drive back immediately after this. He really made an effort to be here with us to talk about an important topic. And this will be a policy discussion about the economy, something a little different, I think, for one of these conferences, and something I hope you'll enjoy. But Mark has been at the Chamber for 18 years, am I right on that? 18 years at the Chamber, really on the forefront of economic liberty and good economic policy. He is one of the smartest thinkers I know in the state on not only economy, but politics, on liberty, on the rule of law, and a whole range of issues. So I'm not going to belabor the introduction because I want to give us a chance to talk. Please join me in welcoming Mark Wilson, President of the Florida Chamber. Just ask that we move the podium back so these folks can see. Thank you. Well, Mark, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Great to be here.
So we're going to try to just have a conversation on a range of issues here, and we'll see where it goes. Again, I was going to moderate between you and Mr. McIntosh. What I will try to do is tee up some of those questions still, maybe take the positions I thought he would, and we can just see where it goes. But before we do that, I do want to set a little bit of context. For those of you who pay more attention to the law than the economy, just to give you the context about where we've been in Florida, we've really had an incredible swing in the last 10 years. We were a state that during the Great Recession lost 1 million private sector jobs. We had unemployment go to greater than 11%. We lost GDP for 4 years, including by 6% 1 year, which is an incredible, really staggering GDP loss. The housing market stumbled. And we've had, as deep and bad as that recession was, we've had a swing the other way now. We've had more than 1 million private sector jobs created, unemployment at 5%, getting close to what most economists would call full employment. We have the all-time record for job openings in the state right now at 300,000, and we have a housing market that is coming back. So that's very good news for the state, but we do have this economy that swings back and forth in a boom and bust cycle. The governor has talked about trying to diversify the economy to get away from that a bit. But that's the good news, and I wanted to share that with you. But Mark, I'd also like to unpack that a little bit. And so we're hearing all this good news about Florida's economy. I'm wondering if you can tell us, not so much what your thoughts are about the economy right now, but even in the midst of good news and 1 million private sector jobs, as president of the chamber who looks forward, what are you worried about over the next 5, 10, or 15 years? What are you hopeful about for our state and the nation as a whole in terms of the economy?
Right. Well, Jesse, thank you for that question. And I can't help but thanking all of you for the opportunity to be here today. When I got the call, I won't read the email change that we had back and forth. And by the way, Tim, I had a much kinder introduction than you did. So thank you very much, Jesse, for that. But I have to tell you, it was a high honor to get the request to be here today. And I apologize to you that my colleague from Club for Growth couldn't make it in today. I think it's important that I say this right up front. I think what you would have found is that both the Chamber of Commerce, the Florida Chamber, and Club for Growth, and many others, are actually on the same side. We're all conservative, trying to push for a bigger private sector and a smaller public sector, and more freedom and less intrusion in our lives. And I think what's happening in our country is we're arguing, the finer points of the issue, and that's what's important. But my fear, you ask me, what am I worried about? We're going to have time for questions, I think, too. So I really want you to start thinking about that. I think the dialogue's very important. I think what I worry most about as president of, clearly the one state in America that is setting an example in many areas for the rest of the country, what I worry about are a couple of things. One, I think the level of paranoia And you know, the level of paranoia in this country right now, you know, if someone says you're a Democrat or someone says you're a Republican, all of a sudden we don't care what you think anymore, right? So polarization and paranoia is something that is really a concern of mine, and I hope we get to get back to that. The other concern is, Jesse, is one of apathy. And if you expected the Chamber of Commerce president to come here and tell you that all businesses are great and all Chamber of Commerces are great, I'm gonna give you bad news. I think the business community in many ways is part of this paranoia and this polarization. And I think that we have to return to, we have to remember what free enterprise is and what it is that made this country great and how we create wealth and how we grow a private sector. And I think sometimes, Jesse, what happens is, I think when you combine term limits and you combine a media that is in no way interested in the truth, and, you know, Tim, you all were talking about civics, right? You're talking about the governor, and, you know, it's nice when he's interviewing people to talk about the separation of powers. We don't teach that in our schools anymore. And, you know, when you think about what we don't teach in civics anymore, this was a predictable moment in time for our country. So I'll say this, and then I'll get back to the next question. If Florida was a stock, right? So if we were to compare this ultimately to the free market, if Florida was a stock, I would buy every bit of it that I possibly could. If you look at the fundamentals, our K-12 education system went from bottom 10 to top 10. You know, if you look at we created one out of every 11 jobs in the United States last year. If you look at the debt that we've paid down, if you look at the fundamentals of what's going on in our state, most places wish that they could be Florida. But what keeps me up at night is how fragile this situation is. And I hope we get to talk about that throughout our panel, because most people think, you know, things are headed in the right direction, so I'm just going to go back to what I was doing before. And that is not what made this country great. And I fear that we're at a moment in time where politics are changing, demographics changing, economics are changing, and the rest of the world, you know, they're not going to wait for us. They're going to pass us by. And I think Florida, this sounds like a cliche, but I wake up every day, you know, third largest state in the country, over 1 million jobs in 5 years, a private sector that's growing. But I wake up every day knowing that we are this close to losing that. And there's a lot of people who wake up every day who think, you know, bigger government, more regulation, more litigation is actually what's best for consumers, despite what the facts say. So anyway, I really appreciate that question. And there's a lot going right in our state. I'm the chair-elect of our National Conference of State Chambers, and I can tell you most of my peers around the country, their calls to me are, how are you doing this in Florida? I was in California recently, and they wanted to know how our fourth grade reading scores are number one in the United States, number two in the world behind Hong Kong. And I'll never forget 800 chambers of commerce in a room, and their question was, where did you find the money to do it? And my point to them is, it's actually, we did this with less money than we had before. Education's not about more money. It's about expecting better outcomes and making the tough call and having the courage. So lots of great stories about Florida. I'm very optimistic about where we're going, though I'm not all that optimistic about what's happening at the federal level.
Well, thanks for that, Mark. It reminds me, when I first came to work for the governor, I asked him why he took the job, and we had a discussion about that. But one of the things he said to me that really stuck with me was, I'm worried about the direction of the country, and I believe Florida is so big and so important that if we can demonstrate here how to make economic policy work, essentially where Florida goes, the nation will follow. So it is certainly not easy to maintain, but we do have this national prominence that many other smaller states do not have, being the third largest state. One of the things I like about your presentations is I consider you somewhat of a demographic wizard, a statistical wizard. You have really a great knack for conveying to an audience sort of Florida in the bigger picture. I'm wondering if you could briefly share with us so we could get on to some other topics, but what is Florida going to look like if things stay steady as they are now in terms of population growth, the economy, in 2030? How many people will we have? What will that, what will the state look like? What do we need to plan for?
So that's a great question. So I made a comment a minute ago, if Florida was a stock, I'd buy all of it, right? That doesn't mean we don't have challenges, because we do. But let me just paint the picture for you. So 20 million people today. But if you think a little longer term than, say, a year or two from now, by 2030, so in less than 15 years, we'll have 6 million more residents in Florida, right? So 20 million to 26 million. We have 100 million visitors to our state right now, okay? In 15 years, that will go to 159 million visitors. So when you start, I mean, that's more than California, Texas, Ohio. You know, we can go right on down the line. You can add Canada into that mix. It's unbelievable what's going to happen. Every 85 new visitors to our state is one new full-time job. So when you stop and think what makes our cash register ring, those of you who live in this state, we don't have a personal income tax. And I ask you, next time you're on an elevator in a hotel, this one included, ask the person where's home. And when they say somewhere like New Jersey or Illinois, say, hey, they have a personal income tax there, don't they? And you can thank them, say thank you, because you're the reason I don't. My point is, we're adding 6 million people and 59 million more visitors in 15 years. I would ask you, where else in the world is there that kind of economic opportunity where you don't even have to leave, right? That's point one. But it also presents challenges. So you've heard a lot about the water bill that we helped write and that the governor just signed last week. So why is that so important? In 15 years, we need 28% more water in Florida to meet the growing population and to meet the visitors. You've seen what happened in California. They invested billions and they didn't do it right. They didn't do science-based, evidence-based water policy. Florida now has the best water policy in the United States, and we're now in a position to get ahead of needing 2 billion more gallons of water by the year 2030. I could say the same thing about energy, by the way. You hear a lot of conversation about energy. By 2035, right, another 5 years onto my projection, we need 76% more electricity in Florida. So you can get there by producing more, you can get there by efficiency, you could have, you know, your government can get involved, which we don't recommend, but we need to do this. But Jesse, 6 million more people, to be at 5% unemployment in 2030, we need 2 million more jobs in the private sector in Florida. So our recommendation is that every conversation start off with, how are we doing against these 2 million net new jobs that need to be created by 2030? Because if you want to know what makes the cash register ring, it's jobs, right? So when governments tell us they need more money, the last thing we should do is raise taxes. The first thing we should do is, well, then how do we create another 200 jobs in this community? Because that's how you make a cash register ring. And I know not everybody agrees with that, but that's free enterprise 101.
Great, thank you. And that I think that's important for people to think about when they consider the economic news we have, is where is it we need to get to? And when you put it in those terms, it's very stark. 2 million is a lot of jobs.
You know, Jesse, one other thing too. A lot of times, most of you are from Florida, and a lot of times, you know, we're not hearing in the newspapers and online or anywhere else, and certainly not on TV, sort of how big of a deal Florida is. And I think, but before we get into other issues, let me put it in perspective. If Florida was a country, right? If we were our own country, you heard about fourth grade reading scores, we'd be number one in the United States, number two in the world. But if we were a country, if you look at our GDP, we are 18th in the world, right? If you're wondering if that's a big deal, that's one ahead of Saudi Arabia. And if you're also wondering if that's a big deal, you heard about the little problem Greece had with their economy and what a big deal that was around the world, especially in Europe. Greece, the entire GDP, the entire economy of Greece fits inside of the economy of Miami. So if you're wondering if Florida's a big deal, Florida's a big deal. And if I had to end right now, I would tell you the one thing we need to do is start comparing our metrics to countries around the world, to Mexico, Brazil, and others. This is not just Florida versus Georgia, Tennessee, Texas, and others. We're in a global situation now.
Thank you for that. And a programming note I should have started with at the beginning. As you may have noted, the lunch started a little late because of all of the great camaraderie in the hallways. We're a little behind on panels, so we will go a little after 2 o'clock. There'll be a chance for everybody to ask questions. And if you're feeling a little tired, just dig into a second dessert that may be next to you and get a sugar rush. So let's ours is sitting there, right?
Exactly. I see it.
Let's dive into a few specific issues. Let's start with one we're hearing a lot about as we watch presidential debates on either side. But every candidate has put out a quote-unquote tax plan. And we hear this every single election, which is, if I'm elected president, I am going to reform the federal tax system, and here is what I do, and no president reforms the federal tax system. My question for you, and you can answer this on a federal basis or on a state basis, or hopefully both, what realistically can we get to in terms of a tax system, and what would be best for free enterprise and economic growth? What, when you think about as a president of the chamber, these are our three key initiatives on taxes, what do you want to see at a federal and state level that you can realistically obtain, assuming you have a friendly president in Congress?
Right. So the question when we talk about taxes, there's a federal question and a state question. And let me just say this. I am one of the most optimistic people you're ever going to meet. I have essentially given up that Washington can fix anything in my lifetime, right? And so I may be the only person in here who feels that way, but the corollary to that is I'm motivated to say, what can we do in Florida to compete with other states to show Washington how you do it? How do you grow the private sector? And my proof point on this would be, I told you when other state chambers get together, they're asking me, how do you do it? We have cut taxes over 50 times in 5 years, yet we've had a surplus every year in our state budget. And to people who don't understand economics and free market, they're completely confused. How in the world do you have a $1 billion surplus when you're cutting taxes? So let me just, at the federal level, let me tell you what I tell the Wall Street Journal when they call. And that is this. If I became president of the United States, right, they asked me, what would you do to get the U.S. economy going? And I said, I would do absolutely nothing. And let me explain what my State of the Union address would be. To all of you who are looking to invest billions of dollars in creating private sector jobs, don't worry. We are not going to keep increasing regulations and litigation and taxation. Believe it or not, and this sounds counterintuitive, what businesses want most is stability and predictability. They would rather have a bad rule that's going to stay around for 20 years over the life cycle of my investment than to say, invest your money now, but don't worry, we're going to keep changing it. My case in point would be, you know, we have a Super Bowl coming up, and I would submit to you that if one of the teams got to bring their own officials, their own judge, and after a 20-yard pass, the other team said, sorry, that's not a first down anymore, right? And then all of a sudden they said, okay, fine. And then they make it to the end zone and they say, sorry, that doesn't count. You actually have to get in twice. What I would submit to you is that the fans wouldn't pay to watch it. You couldn't sell commercials on TV. Nobody would want to play. But this is exactly what we're doing to American business right now. We're telling them we want the jobs and then we keep on changing the rules. And so in that framework, what I would say to you, Jesse, is what could get done. I think what can get done is I think there is a push. I think there is energy for tax reform. The problem is we want a much flatter tax, a much more simplified way of doing this. The problem is the people on the other side want more taxes. And so the trade that you have to get is one where they think it's a zero-sum game, right? So how are we going to get more taxes if we reduce the complexity in the tax code? There's VAT taxes, there's flat taxes, there's all kinds of tax schemes that are out there at the federal level. You know, we just got back from Singapore on a trade mission, and if you think about what they do, right? No corporate taxes for 3 years and then 17% forever. That is the perfect combination of an incentive and a forever promise that we're not going to make changes. Where would you invest your next $10 million? Where it's consistent and predictable and proven? Or where the political risk is so great that you have no idea if you're ever going to see a return on that capital. So the specifics of a tax code, believe it or not, in our opinion, are actually not as important as the foreverness and the predictability and stability. And I know that sounds like heresy, but please don't underestimate the importance of the promise that these are the rules and this is what you can count on. Now back to the state for a second. I think here's an example where the state is setting a national example by anyone's standards. So we do not have a personal income tax in this state, although I would support a personal income tax on trial lawyers, and I've said that publicly on many occasions. And by the way, don't let anybody tell you businesses don't support taxes, because that would help fund, you know, kids that don't have health care and all kinds of things. So there's a lot of merit to that policy. We can talk about that at another conference. But we do have a corporate income tax. And here's what I want you to know. When the governor was elected, he called and we had a conversation about how do we phase out this corporate income tax. And we came up with an idea where we would begin to ratchet back, right, the businesses that pay the corporate income tax. So here's what you need to know. In Florida, 81% of the businesses that used to pay the corporate income tax when Governor Scott was elected no longer pay the corporate income tax, because we keep on leveraging that. Now, you haven't heard that story because media is not going to tell you that story. But now what we want to do, the governor's just announced another $1 billion tax package. Now what we want to do is begin rolling back and permanently eliminating the corporate income tax. And rather than do it by ratcheting down the percentage like we have been doing, the governor's idea is to actually start targeting entire sectors of the economy. So manufacturing is a good example. Manufacturing, for every 10 manufacturing jobs you create, you actually create 20 non-manufacturing jobs. You need lawyers, you need finance, you need warehousing, you need distribution. And these are jobs that pay about 20% higher wages than average wages in most communities. So by completely eliminating the sales tax on machinery and equipment and completely eliminating the corporate income tax, you're actually, and then of course you do retail, you do services, you eventually phase out everybody. It's not like you're picking a winner and treating one person differently. I don't know if the House and Senate are going to go along with that. The Senate seems to be concerned that, you know, giving that much money back to the taxpayers is a little bit too tricky right now. But the great news is the House has been incredibly aggressive. They've essentially matched the governor's dollar amount. And I don't know what the final package will look like. But I will tell you, thank goodness we're in a state where we're talking about giving tax dollars back to small businesses and families where they came from, because they'll invest them in growing the business and in the community. So that's essentially where we are. I think Florida is setting the national example on where to go on taxes. I don't know whether the federal government will, maybe if Congressman DeSantis gets up there, he just stepped out, but I don't know what they're going to do. I just know that at the end of the day, we want something predictable and something that's stable, so that when we make an investment in America, you know that it's not going to change and that the political risk isn't going to get you.
Thank you for that. I have three things that came to mind as you were talking about that. First, just to go back to the Super Bowl analogy, I hope I wasn't the only one in here thinking that the Patriots may actually do that, bring their own officials to a Super Bowl. A couple of Dolphins fans at least in the room, right? I'm a Jets fan, so you know it's very personal for me. Two, you know, you noted how many fewer businesses are paying the corporate income tax, and something that I came across in my time at the Department of Economic Opportunity was we broke down businesses in this state and just who they are, and we have somewhere between 400 and 5,000 businesses that employ other people in the state. And I think it will surprise many folks in this room to understand just how that breaks down. 90% of those businesses have less than 250 employees, and 70%, so still a super majority of businesses in the state, have less than 5 employees. So when we talk about a tax burden or a regulatory burden, you really are talking about what truly is small business. The federal government defines small business, I think, is less than 500 employees. So the vast majority of businesses, all businesses and job creators in our state, are truly small and do not have an army of lawyers and lobbyists and accountants who can help them with taxes and regulation.
You know, Jesse, if I could just make a point too. You know, words matter, and Jesse's talking about small businesses. So 2 out of 3 jobs in Florida are created by small businesses, and in our world, that's under 100. But let me tell you what I think the danger is in even talking about small businesses. If Bill Gates walked in that door right now, he would tell you that he's an entrepreneur and that he operates like a small business. And I just want to make the point. I would encourage us to think about how important entrepreneurism is, and how much we can do to kill job creation by telling entrepreneurs that they're a new idea, we're gonna regulate it, and then we're gonna litigate it. And you know what? We gotta figure out a way to tax that thing. And so, in fact, if we have time, I'd love to ask you about some of the new innovations and your thoughts on them. But I wanted to point out small businesses employ most people in Florida. This is where the job creation comes from. But remember, it's the entrepreneur who took the risk in the first place, and that's what we have to honor. And just let's just not get caught up in the words.
Well, let's take it there. So two topics. One, you mentioned as you were talking about taxes, not picking winners and losers. So I want to talk a little bit about economic incentives. There's a great debate. For example, if Mr. McIntosh was up here, the Club for Growth takes one position on the Export-Import Bank, and Economic Incentives Chamber takes another. I want to talk about that, and then I also want to talk about technology and free enterprise. So why don't we start with technology, and then we'll go to the incentives. The Chamber has taken the position, a strong position on taxation of internet sales. I'm wondering if, and that's a topic that even if people aren't litigating that issue or thinking about the legislation, everybody here is buying off of Amazon and eBay and other services. Tell us the Chamber's position, why you take it, and then what is your, I'll sort of articulate the other position and you can respond to that.
Yeah, so just to be clear what we're talking about here, so you're required by law to pay taxes on most everything you buy if it's a retail purchase. And it doesn't matter where you bought it, right? So let's first level set what we're talking about. So if I walk in, if I leave here today and I go over to this gift shop, right? I am required to pay a sales tax on that purchase. We would all agree that that's what happens. If I go to my room and jump online, if there's a brick and mortar store, right? If I'm going to Disney.com and ordering that from Disney.com, there's a brick and mortar store. They're required to collect that tax. If I buy it from an out-of-state retailer that doesn't have a store and employees in Florida, they're not required to collect that tax at the point of sale. But here's the part you're not told. You're required to then go to the Florida Department of Revenue's website, download a form, and say, I just bought something for $117, and I'm going to calculate and submit to you a separate check.
Take a survey question. How many people in this room have done that? Just kidding. There are a lot of those. There's something like 4,000 filings a year, so not many of the 20 million Floridians.
Our governor's general counsel is here. I want to make sure you see my hand is up.
A couple of judges need to put their hand up, too. We're only recording this side of the conversation.
So here's the point. Here's the point. This often gets spun into a political conundrum of why do you want to raise taxes and why do you want to tax the internet? And it's unfortunate that that's where the conversation goes. Let me tell you, I believe the solution to this is to no longer require retailers to collect the tax. So I believe the solution is, since I'm required to pay the tax, whether I buy it at Jesse's store, from Disney, from Publix, or online somewhere, what I believe is, let's treat everyone the same. Let's either say, you know what, why would we mandate a business collect the tax in the first place? Why don't we just say the consumer owes it? And by the way, this is not a change in law, this is fact. Why don't we just say the consumer owes it, so the consumer has to go figure out a way to pay it? Or say it doesn't matter who the retailer is, the retailer is required to collect it. Why do we say if you invest in a building and in employees and pay property taxes in Florida, we're going to mandate that you collect the tax? But if you buy it from an out-of-state retailer, Amazon's a good example. They used to be an out-of-state retailer, but the moment they built their first distribution here, they're actually now required to collect it too, right? So the point of this is this gets so spun up in a political conversation and it gets so far off base, it gets advocated that why are you for an increase in taxes? Say, no, we're not. As a matter of fact, if there's a net increase in collections, then why don't we reduce the rate so that we're not increasing the amount that's coming in, and let's let the consumers, you know, keep what they should. But this is an unfair penalty to businesses who are investing in their community right now. The government is requiring you to collect the tax and not requiring an out-of-state retailer. And the biggest argument against it is, you know, frankly, a tired argument of, oh, well, we couldn't have these small businesses. They could never calculate the sales tax. Well, how the heck does FedEx and UPS, you know, in less than a nanosecond calculate the cost to ship something to my front door, right? We have software to do this stuff now. So we have yet to find a good reason not to do this. And I think we should either say retailers shouldn't be required to collect it, or we should require everybody to collect it. I don't know why we're having the debate, to be honest.
Great, thank you. Well, you've articulated.
Now I'd love to hear your side of it.
Well, I want to ask you, and we can talk a little bit about this, but there is a great debate going on in this country, another issue on technology and free enterprise. The internet, iPhones have changed everything. We have these new apps that are sort of revolutionizing many economies. The most notable example, probably right now, is Uber and other ride-sharing technology. And so there's a very significant debate going on in the country about how to regulate those. And there are some bills in the Florida legislature. There are some talk of national legislation. Where is the chamber on that issue, and sort of what are your thoughts?
So, Jesse, what I think all of you know is, it's funny you talked about the WWJD earlier, Tim. The truth is, I've called this guy at least 100 times in his tenure at the state, and we would have lunch, and I actually pick your brain on things. And this is actually an issue that I've actually reached out to you in the past on. I was actually going to ask you this question, if you would share your perspective. Ours, no surprise, is the same as on the internet sales tax issue. It's, we should treat everybody the same. And in the case of, say, an Uber or a taxi service, what's so hard about treating everybody the same? Let's just have everybody play by the same rules. And I think we have a tendency, you know, I can imagine the Wright brothers showing up outside and figuring out how to fly it, and somebody in government would go, oh, I've got to regulate that thing. Hadn't seen that before. And I think that's a little bit of where we're at right now, is we're trying to regulate innovation, and that's exactly the opposite of what this country's done for 200 and some years.
Well, and I appreciate that, and I guess what I would say partially is, you know, the taxi cab industry is one that benefited from a government-issued monopoly that they lobbied for very hard to get. And the cost of that, the price of that, was that they are heavily regulated. And now that a disruptor has come in, they no longer like the price they paid for a government-issued monopoly that technology is breaking. And so it is a bit disingenuous to sort of hear that industry say, well, you need to regulate the new technology because we're regulated. Well, you were regulated because you got a free monopoly for 50 years. The issue we had at the department was whether, and this is happening in, there's a suit in California, there's a quote-unquote advisory opinion from the Labor Commission of Commissioner of Oregon. I didn't get to do those, so I don't really know what those are, but he just opined. But the question there is whether Uber drivers and other rideshare providers are independent contractors or employees of the company, and ultimately we adjudicated that at the department, and our position was under Florida law very firmly, they're independent contractors for two reasons that made us quite different from California. One, in California, they sort of said, and Oregon followed this, we don't really care what the contract says. And luckily, Florida law still says that contracts matter, that the written agreement that two parties come to has meaning in the law. And we look first to the contract. So that made it somewhat easy because we looked at the contract and it said very explicitly, this is an independent contractor relationship. But two, then we look to the actual course of dealing, and everything in the course of dealing between, almost everything in the course of dealing between Uber and a provider for Uber was, the control was with the driver. They choose where to work, when to work, how many hours, what car to drive, whether to work at all. I don't know many employers that would say you can do virtually anything you want. You can just leave for 6 months and you'll still be my employee. So the nature of the relationship. And then lastly, I think what those states are having trouble seeing is that the profession that Uber appears to be in has been around for thousands of years, and it's simply that of a middleman. And just because we now have a platform that allows you to be a middleman for thousands, if not millions of people, doesn't mean you're not still a middleman. And we said it was akin to, nobody would call an art gallery the employee of an artist. They're a middleman for selling those works of art, and Uber is essentially a middleman for the provision of transportation services. Well, we've got probably about total of 15 minutes to go, so let me quickly ask you, and I think this is important because if you and David were here, this was going to be a very good debate. So economic incentives, tax incentives, known in some circles in this room probably as quote-unquote corporate welfare, you know, handouts for corporations, and what we're talking about here, different from state to state, some states give cash grants for companies to come to their state and create jobs or retain jobs. Florida now operates more on a tax rebate system or a pay-for-performance system, but in the end, it is a specific financial treatment that is targeted to one company at a time, not the economy overall. Many sort of libertarian conservatives take the view that we shouldn't be doing that. The chamber has been supportive of our competitive economic development efforts. Tell us why you think the business of individualized tax incentives is important or a good thing, and respond to some of what we hear from, say, Americans for Prosperity or the Club for Growth or others.
Yeah, so it might surprise you to hear, I actually think there's going to be a day where all incentives are gone, right? That the tax incentive at the local government or state government or federal are gone. And that's frankly the way it should be, okay? So let me start with an agreement that tax incentives are very much part of all 50 states' way that they try to compete with each other right now. Each state has a different strategy. I would tell you, Florida, in my opinion, has the most conservative targeted way of doing this. So if you heard what Jesse just said, in many other states, they might say, hey, we like that Tim's going to add some jobs, so we're gonna send $500,000 Tim's way, and he's going to use that, and we hope good things are going to happen. In Florida, if we liked Tim's industry and we wanted to invest in what Tim was doing, we would say, Tim, you create those jobs. After you've created those jobs, we'll go back and provide an incentive for you, but you have to make your own investment and actually prove it out first. So understand, most of the criticisms of tax incentives around the country are where there's no discipline on the front end, they're throwing money at companies when they shouldn't be, and there's a hope that there's a payback, hoping they're going to allure somebody to plant a seed in their community, it's going to grow. Florida is one of the most conservative ways to do this. So that's one reason I sleep good at night on that conversation. But I will tell you, what we should be doing between now and when we get rid of incentives, we need to be much more disciplined than we've been disciplined recently. We were not disciplined before this governor for a couple of years, where any job was something we would incentivize. And so I think if my friend from Club for Growth were here, I think we would actually agree on where we ultimately need to get to. The problem is, in any war, anywhere in the world, when you unilaterally disarm, then what you're doing is, in the short term, you're saying, you know what, that cancer research facility, that biotechnology facility, that nanotechnology facility, that 800-person manufacturing, that auto plant, what drives other indirect jobs, we're basically saying we don't want them here.
So Mark, can I ask you a question on that, since this is a Federalist Society conference with a theme of federalism? Would you support a federal law that prohibited state-based individualized tax incentives, and therefore would not unilaterally disarm, but immediately disarm every state?
I would want to think about that. I would have a hard time with that, because I think my problem with having a hard time with that isn't what you said. It's what would the federal government then do when they have all the control? Right? They could do things with tax rates, they could do things with new regulations. What I would prefer to do is say, federal government, we're not going to do any more Solyndra-type deals, there is no more federal government involvement in incentives at all, and instead say to the states, our preference is that you don't do this, but if you do, have fun competing with each other. And the ultimate return on investment question should be to the taxpayers in that state, and ultimately to the voters in that state. And Look, I think we're headed toward a day where we don't do this in Florida. Let me be very clear. But we have an incredibly broken legal climate in this state, and everyone knows it. We spend more trial lawyer ads on billboards and TV than any other state in the United States. It's because it's broken. So until we fix the cost of doing business, we can never come up with enough government tax incentives to overcome some of these challenges. So what we need to do is we need to make Florida more competitive, right? And at the same time, we need to eventually phase out these tax incentives, because that's what the Florida model's all about. Other states, you know, let them do it, because states like New York, whose same population but has twice the budget, think about it. Their state budget's twice Florida's. Every time they give free money away for free education or free incentives, it actually advantages Florida. And final comment I would make on that, as we wrap up, I don't know if you pay attention to the amount of income and wealth that is leaving other states and moving to states like Florida, but let me just give a perspective to you. Every minute of every day, 7 days a week, $13,000 of income moves into Florida. $13,000 a minute. Every minute, every day, 7 days a week. Do the math. $5 million of income every 5 hours is moving into our state, right? That's because people want to be here, right? And so when and that's without any incentives, unless you call no personal income tax an incentive, right? Our education system's moving in the right direction, our tax structure's moving in the right direction. Tax incentives are not the answer. And where we would disagree with Club for Growth is some people want to get rid of them today at 5 o'clock. And I would just say to you, anything that you've been doing for decades is going to need 3 to 5 to 10 years to wind down. So we're arguing about when, not arguing about the goal.
We have time for a couple of questions. If there are any that are already teed up, does somebody have a microphone? Oh, and I didn't see this, but want to recognize our Lieutenant Governor, Carlos Lopez Quintero, has come into the room, a great champion for job growth in the state. So thank you. And I think, Governor, you probably have a few minutes to stick around at the end if people want to mix and mingle with you, so we would welcome that. We do want to take probably 2 or 3 questions, and then we'll close out and get to the next panel. So I see one in the center here. Can somebody just grab a mic and bring it over there? Our MC, Judge Scales, thank you very much.
So if you could, this session, you know, get the legislature to pass one piece of legislation that would be favorable for business or business development, what would it be?
Wow, that's a great question. I would put 4 or 5 things into one bill, is what Mark Wilson would do.
There's a constitutional prohibition on that, some of these large. Yeah, then loosely enforced.
Then I would do a constitutional, I would do a joint resolution and make it a constitutional amendment. I think that there are so many important things like tax incentives and some of the others that frankly, if they don't happen this year, we still need to get them done. But I worry more about if this were a bucket, you know, there's 1,000 people a day moving into Florida. And if this were a bucket, we can't add enough people and jobs if we don't fix the holes in the bottom of the bucket. I think our lawsuit abuse climate in Florida right now is so much worse. The business community knows it. Right? Our politicians don't want to admit it because they know the political consequences that happen. Tim, you talked about the governor's opinion. The reason we invested more in Governor Scott's reelection than any other group in Florida was largely because of his appointments that were going to be coming. And what would have happened, what the consequences would have been if it would have been someone else making those appointments. And so if you're asking me as president of the Florida Chamber of Commerce, there are some legal reforms that there are scams, in my opinion, that are going on in Florida because of the way that this works. And I think that if you think about what I said earlier about predictability and stability, you know, you look at bad faith claims, you look at what's happening right now on interest issues. I mean, what's happening right now is keeping me up at night because I think the average voter doesn't understand that in Florida, it's costing the average family of Florida $3,400 a year in lawsuit abuse taxes, right? Every one of these billboards that says sue someone, right? The largest personal injury trial lawyer firm in the nation is headquartered here in Orlando, and they get 10,000 calls every week saying, who can I sue, right? This is a problem. So as much as I'd like to tell you that it's about a tax incentive or it's about an economic development issue, these are very important issues. But we need to close the holes in the bottom of the bucket if we expect this thing to keep growing at the way that it does. So if 21 senators walked in here and said, what do you most want? It would be in the area of fixing our broken legal climate, in our opinion, at the chamber.
Okay, probably have time for 2 more questions if they're short. Anybody else? Questions? There's one in the middle, but Judge, if you see somebody, go for it.
Thank you, and thank you for your comments. As you know, I'm sort of a tax cutter with portability and things like that. And I appreciate your notion that on the federal level, maybe we need status quo more than change. But there's one area I'd like you to comment where we desperately need change, and that's on taxing at the full rate repatriation of funds from overseas. We've suffered a series of inversions, and I don't know if you saw the paper the other day, but Sotheby's company needs to bring some money here When they do that, their net worth goes down by 35% with the bring, so they've eliminated the dividend. As Florida becomes more of a multinational advantage from the global economy, don't we need to do something about repatriation of funds at the full tax rate?
Yeah, so Carl, thank you for that. Jesse, you may have comments on that as well. I'll just tell you two things. So we have an international trade office in Miami, and we're very focused on how do we bring more jobs to Florida, how do we bring more investment back into the United States, back into Florida. And I would just tell you there's two parts to that, Carl. One, it was a bit of a myth that we're better off to make things somewhere else, right? I could tell you about companies who tried manufacturing in India, or companies that have tried manufacturing in China, and they're now bringing jobs back here because our workforce is better, our talent is better. So there's people want to come back, and then they run into this great big mountain on the tax issue. And we hear this, whether we go to South America, whether we go to the Far East, we hear this everywhere that we go. And it's what I was talking about before. It's common sense that you would do this, right? My teenagers, right, have figured this one out, right? They heard me on the phone literally with a reporter talking about this issue, Carl, and my teenager said, "What? How dumb was that person?" That was literally what my 14-year-old son said. And I said, "Well, let me tell you what their point is." And he said, "Well, why don't we just, you know, make the tax rate lower than what they have to pay now, and wouldn't they all bring it back home?" I have incredible faith in the next generation, because they're looking at these arguments we're having saying, this is just dumb. Why don't we just do this? And so absolutely, we would agree that this is a no-brainer that you do in the short term. I just am not sure I have confidence in the politics in Washington that even something this straightforward is something that they're willing to get done.
Okay, well, thank you for that. By my watch, it is 2:20. We're going to start the next panel at 2:30. So a couple of things, if anyone had questions and they want to ask Mark about them, please feel free in the next few minutes to come up here. If you want to see the Lieutenant Governor, talk to him about statewide policy. He is in the back of the room, and the bathrooms are that way. So thank you all very much. Thank you, Mark, for sharing your time with this crowd.